Welcome to the beginning of a wonderful committee. Today is a happy day. After today, it'll be a little bit different. So why don't we have... Oh, we're going to approve the minutes. Representative Murphy. Representative Murphy moves the minutes. Everyone okay with the minutes? All those in favor, signify by saying aye. Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, a minute adopted. First up, we have Representative Murphy. We're doing Senate file, I believe. We're doing Senate file 29. Representative Murphy moves Senate file 29, recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Health Human Services Policy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Well, Representative Murphy, before we go, here's the plan for the rest of the for this committee. We're going to vote on all bills and send it to Representative Thiessen's committee. And when it gets there, we're going to do a delete all as the omnibus House bill. I'm going to consult with Senate as well before we move forward, but that's my intention anyway. So, Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate File 29 is a very simple bill now. It adds pharmacists to the list of individuals who can administer drugs pursuant to a protocol with a licensed practitioner. And I have with me today Ms. Julie Johnson, who can talk a little bit more about the bill. Thank you.
Ms. Johnson?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the piece that we're talking about today in regard to statute changes from 1999 that gave pharmacists the ability to enter into collaborative practice agreements with physicians to manage drug therapy. These agreements are signed by a physician and allow pharmacists to manage drug therapy specific to what the physician just signed. What's been happening, when these changes are made by the pharmacist under the signed protocol, new prescriptions are generated. It took us a few years to figure this out, but that new prescription, we weren't needed to be co-signed by the physician again under the collaborative practice agreement in order for it to be a valid prescription. So what's been happening is the pharmacists have been running back to the physician after they have already signed the protocol each time they're making a change. So this change would streamline the process, be less burdensome for physicians and for pharmacists. We did have several physicians come to us and say, this is an administrative burden, can you please fix it? And also our Board of Pharmacy asked us as well. We did have discussions with the Medical Association, the Board of Pharmacy, and the Pharmacists Association for this change, and everyone is in agreement.
Oh, good. Are there any opposition to this bill? Are there any questions from the members? Okay. Representative Murphy renews her motion that Senate File 29 be recommended pass and be referred to Health Human Service Policy. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay.
Mr.
Chair. Bill's on its way. Okay. Representative Norton, you're up next. Members, just to let you know, most of these bills have been vetted through the process outside of the committee, and we should be moving pretty quick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move House File 240, and then I have an amendment.
Representative Norton, I believe you want to move Senate File 230.
Oh, yes. You've confused me today.
Representative Norton moves Senate File 230 and recommend it pass and be referred to Health Human Service Policy. Representative Norton.
Yes, Mr. Chair. I would like to move the A2, it's the SO230A2 amendment, please, so that I have the bill in the shape I would like it in for discussion today.
Okay, this is the amendment the author wants to put in the shape that it wants. Is this the A2?
The A2, yes.
Okay. Representative Norton moves the A2 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed? The amendment adopted.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 240 or Senate File 230 seeks to update the statute that regulates physician's assistants and require licensure for the same. Physician's assistants are an increasingly important component of the healthcare system as we look to how to expand access to care in a cost-effective manner. Minnesota's PAs are providing care across the state from community clinics to the inner city, to emergency rooms and to the operating rooms in hospitals, to clinics in rural Minnesota that can't recruit a full-time physician, but need a provider that can provide primary care services. Physician's assistants are healthcare professionals that practice limited medicine with physician supervision. As part of their comprehensive responsibility, PAs conduct physical exams, diagnose and treat illnesses, order and interpret tests, counsel on preventive healthcare, assist in surgery, and write prescriptions. Within the physician-PA relationship, physician assistants exercise autonomy and medical decision-making and provide a broad range of diagnostic and therapeutic services. This bill provides technical updates to the PA statute, but does not expand the scope of practice or alter the physician-PA team practice. The PA statute has not been updated in a number of years, and the statute now contains provisions that are outdated, confusing, or no longer in practice in today's delivery system. The bill has been vetted by the health groups that have an interest, the Minnesota Medical Association, the Board of Medical Practice, and the Department of Health, among others, have reviewed all or parts of the proposal. The PAs have been working with the Board of Medical Practice for 2 years on this proposal, and this bill reflects their input. I'm not aware of any healthcare organization or regulator that has concerns with this bill. I do want to highlight that the bill changes the current registration of PAs to licensure. Mr. Barlow can talk more about that, and I'd like to just give you a couple quick reasons why I'm supporting this change and believe it's appropriate. One of those is that last year the legislature passed health care reform bills that outlined primary care providers and specifically listed PAs in statute. All of the other providers listed were licensed and parity seems in order. Another bill dealing with emergencies and disasters that was enacted into law, and that was a model national bill brought to us by the Department of Health. Among other things, it provided protection to licensed healthcare practitioners that respond to disasters or emergencies, but PAs currently aren't licensed. So that bill did nothing to encourage Minnesota's PAs to respond to disasters that may happen in our state or other states. Even though PAs are healthcare professionals and many of them are trauma specialists and practice in emergency rooms, they were prohibited under current registration in responding to the 35W bridge collapse, and so were unable to help provide trauma care at the bridge site. Under the current statute, they would first have had to file a document with the Board of Medical Practice providing the name of the physician at the disaster site that would have supervised their work and before they could have even assisted one victim, and of course, in a disaster, that isn't reasonable. With that, I'd like to turn the microphone over to Mr. Barlow, a physician's assistant that has been providing care in Minnesota for years and also teaches future PAs at the program at Augsburg College, and he'll discuss the highlights and answer any questions. I also have Walt Rothwell, a constituent of mine, and also has an important role with the physician's assistants in the state, and he will be here to provide technical support, moral support, and assistance.
Okay, Mr. Barlow, state your name for the record, and you may continue. You may start.
My name is Dave Barlow. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I want to thank you for this opportunity to present testimony today. I'm currently the president of the Minnesota Academy of Physician Assistants, and as Representative Norton stated, I'm also a practicing PA and teach at Augsburg College. I currently work in urgent care, also full-time out in Plymouth, Minnesota. PAs are educated in the medical model and practice medicine as members of physician-directed teams. We're committed to that team principle. We're not looking for any change in that and this bill does not change that. As Representative Norton stated, PAs work in all aspects of medicine, including inner city, rural, surgery, and primary care. The bill currently before you is mainly aimed at cleaning up technical language, not a scope of practice bill. The legislation has been reviewed by a wide variety of organizations and reflects their input. It's been endorsed by the Minnesota Medical Association, Minnesota Academy of Family Physicians, Minnesota Osteopathic Medical Society, Minnesota Chapter of the American College of Physicians, and the Minnesota Medical Directors Association. We also are not aware of any concerns and have been working with the Board of Medical Practice for a couple of years on this legislation. Briefly, some things that this does accomplish. As Representative Norton stated, we're changing terminology from registration to licensure. Many people already assume we are licensed. People that hire us often assume we are licensed and advertise for licensed practitioners. The disaster bill states licensed people can respond. That's become a problem. There are bills before this legislative session that call for licensed healthcare practitioners. We're effectively limited because of that language and are just looking to get on par with the language and with other groups. We're one of only, I believe it's 6 states that are not licensed, if I recall. Expanding the number of PAs a physician may choose to supervise from 2 to 5 is another goal of this bill. Allowing exceptions to this limit with the Board of Medical Practice approval under the disaster clause. Modification of the disaster clause to allow PAs to offer their services without the need for an established delegation agreement. Clarity on the issue of delegation of authority to sign a 72-hour emergency hold. And this is an important fact. It's already in place, but it's not clear to a lot of people. In my own setting, I was working this weekend and had a patient who was threatening suicide. He came into urgent care voluntarily. Not necessarily the right place for somebody threatening suicide, but if the language is not clear, I wouldn't have been able to put a 72-hour hold. In that case, I didn't need to. He was there voluntarily and went to the emergency room of his own accord. The main things it does not do, and we want to make these very clear, it's probably more important what the bill does not do. It does not create a new profession. PAs have been practicing in Minnesota since 1971 and have been in existence for 40 years. It does not create new regulation of an existing profession. The educational requirements for licensure will be the same as for registration. The requirement for certification by the National Commission on Certification of Physician Assistants remains unchanged. The requirement for continuing medical education will continue, and all current disciplinary provisions stay in place. It does not change a physician assistant's scope of practice. The scope of practice of a PA is determined by the supervising physician. The bill removes some ambiguities, such as clarifying the ability of a supervising physician to delegate the authority to sign a 72-hour hold, but does not change our scope. It does not change the supervisory relationship with physicians. The name of the document is changed and the flow of the paperwork is streamlined in some areas. The PA must still have a physician assistant delegation agreement completed prior to practicing. It does not provide any independent authority to PAs. The only authority a PA has to practice medicine is a delegated authority from supervising physicians. In the circumstance of an emergency or a disaster, the PA will be allowed to provide care without formal supervision in writing, but there will still be supervision available. So thank you again, Chairman Sal and committee members, for scheduling this bill for a hearing and the opportunity to address the committee. I'd be happy to answer any questions that you or the members may have.
Okay. I believe we have Representative Abler. Is the A1 yours, your amendment? Are you?
No, I don't have that. Well, I have a question, but I have no amendment. The author was very kind to take care of our concerns.
Thank you.
That was very nice. Thank you.
Representative Abler.
I do have a couple of questions. And, actually, I've been on this committee for my 11th year, I think, of messing with this stuff. So I helped disaster stuff in the past, and I just saw a few changes there. And I'm just curious. And, you know, your profession has certainly come a long ways over the years, even in 11 years, and I don't know, remember when it started. But just two questions. On page 22, There was some stuff taken away. Is that about all the stricken language on page 22, is that replaced or is that redundant or you don't need it anymore?
Mr. Bartle?
Yes, Chairman Fowle, Representative Abler. That area is referring to internal protocol, I believe.
That was part of it, yeah.
The internal protocol has been something that's been very ambiguous. It's a separate document that neither employers, supervising physicians, or in large respect the board knew what to really do with.
Oh.
It was a duplication of our supervisory agreement, and so it's just to eliminate it so that it's not an issue in writing. It doesn't add anything more. It's just eliminating that internal protocol, which was a redundancy of the supervisory agreement, which is already in place.
And I recall the supervisory agreement is the heart of your practice. I have one other question. Thank you. That's helpful. And the other thing about just you mentioned disasters, and I remember I might have carried legislation to help you do it. But there's just a question of liability I have, which when you, on page 25, line 25, when you're working without a supervisory agreement, and it is a disaster, and I understand that's a unique circumstance, having carried the, whatever the Health Powers Act and that whole matter, which was done some years ago with worrying about liability, what's the track of liability here? Does the PA carry their own liability insurance if something should happen? Because in this case, the supervisor person is not liable, and they're working independent of supervision there. Is that figured out somehow?
Mr. Bartle?
I'm Walt Rockwell. I'm a physician assistant in Rochester. And as I understand it, there is some liability provision that results from the Good Samaritan statute. But beyond that, I think it would be an individual question based on the physician assistant's employment and whether they would be providing care in any way related to their employment. Working in Rochester, I know at the time of the Rushford flood, there were personnel mobilized from Rochester to assist with that, and some of them were physician assistants. So I can see some situations where my personal or professional liability coverage might apply, but I think there will be other instances where a PA would be functioning as part of the local medical community and not necessarily in related to their own employment. So I think it will vary from situation to situation.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, maybe I should just caution you all, because I think it's a gap in liability, either from the patient's point of view or for the PA's point of view. You might be individually liable. Just to caution you. I mean, I'm not objecting. I'm just pointing it out as reading it over, just remembering how we did this before, and they had to get permission and check in and all that before. So all that, do some side work on it, but it's just a question.
I think, Representative Abler, I think you have a pretty good point there, and I would encourage that, Representative Norton. I mean, the last thing we want to do is give you guys this licensure and bring some hardship down the road. So, work on it. And
we'd be happy to do that, Mr. Chair. And I'm guessing that there are in other professions, such as nurse practitioners or others, mm-hmm. that they have this issue comes up as well. And we can double check with some of those and see if, in fact, the emergency the Good Samaritan covers it, or if we need some additional language. Sure. We'll look into that.
Representative Dean?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Same topic, page 25. A little different take on it. But what, Representative Norton, what would be the relationship in this kind of a disaster situation? Not wanting to spend more than one more minute on this, but what is the what's the relationship between the physician and the physician's assistant in an emergency situation? The way 25.25 to 25.33 reads right now.
Representative Norton, or any...
I would defer that to the experts here, please.
Chairman, Mr. Chairman, and Representative Dean, the relationship is really the same as under our supervising physician. We're going to check in at the disaster scene and
make it known what our credential is to be there, as it should be at any disaster, check in with who's running the disaster. The main thing is we will have the ability to practice without having to go to the board and file a new supervisory agreement under that person. They're going to accept the supervision of the PA at the disaster verbally. Otherwise, the disaster could be over before you have a chance to meet with the board, get a supervisory agreement written and in place and approved. We would still be working under the scope of that supervising physician, but it's whichever physicians are there, and they would still need to say, yes, I accept the responsibility for the physician assistant.
Mr. Chair, I think that's probably something he's probably got to button up. I know that in my profession, in Hurricane Katrina, they had Good Samaritan relief for architects who would go in, and yet there was litigation against the firms who hired them. So I think there probably needs to be something going both ways on that before you wrap it up. But that's it.
Okay. Representative Bunn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have some just clarifying questions to ask. Typically, just a little background, typically in this area of regulation, we call licensing, we have registration, certification, and licensure, which are kind of a hierarchy of categories of more and more regulation. And typically, registration is a voluntary thing. It's just putting one's name on a list. It doesn't require any educational necessarily qualifications or even, you know, continuing education or other kinds of, or exams even. And then people who are non-registered can still practice that occupation. It's voluntary. And then the next step, certification, it's still voluntary. Non-certified people can still practice the occupation, but they can't call themselves certified. But there's education and continuing education and examination type of, you know, requirements that are met. And then licensure goes much further to say that no one other than the licensed can practice this occupation. So it's no longer voluntary. It's no longer allowing anyone else to do it. There seems to have been some confusion in the history of this area that doesn't fit that model. So I was just trying to make sense of what we're really doing here. And so I have a couple questions for you, and I'm going to give you three to start with. What year did registration start? Secondly, under the old scheme, could a non-registered person practice, or did they, as a physician's assistant? Third, could those without, were there or are there now physician's assistants who are not certified, who are working in the occupation of physician's assistant, and under what circumstances? So let's start with those.
Mr. Bartle?
Sure.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, to answer your questions, I believe that registration was in 1995. Mm-hmm. Is that correct? Under 147A? I believe.
Mm-hmm.
To the second question, no. People cannot currently practice unless... That's the biggest part of this change from registration to licensure, is that really, in effect, all the things that you stated at the outset about licensure are the way we are right now. We require CME.
Mm-hmm.
We have to be registered in order to practice. It is protective of our title. So it's just really changing the wording to encompass what we're already doing. And the third question was regarding, are there any people...
Currently, are there physician assistants who are not certified by the national NCCPA?
Walt, do you want to answer that? I know there are. You work with some grandfathered folks.
Mr. Rothwell, right?
Yes, Walt Rothwell from Rochester. There was a grandfather provision at the time the current statute was passed,
mm-hmm.
and there are physician assistants in practice who were registered under the provisions of that clause. So they were not nationally certified, and there continue to be some of those individuals in place. The current statute reads that anyone who was eligible for registration in 1995 would continue to maintain their eligibility as long as they don't let it lapse.
Mm-hmm.
And this bill would honor that provision as it currently reads in statute.
Representative Bunn.
Okay. To follow up, under the current bill, other than those ones that are pre-1995, June 30th, 1995, could any one of the current bill not be certified going forward by that organization or its subsequent organizations?
Mr. Russell?
I'm not completely certain I understand the question, but the bill would not exclude anyone who is currently registered. Anyone who has been eligible to register and is currently registered would remain eligible. So those criteria don't change. Does that answer the question?
No, I was asking, there seems to be some language, and I'll give you this particular section. There's language starting on 20.21 and also on 26.5, the first few lines we just said, that suggests to me that even going forward, that not all individuals, and you can put aside for a moment the June 30, 1995 ones, not all individuals will necessarily be certified by the organization for a license, that you give them some other options other than certification by that organization. For example, let me look at the 26.5. Let me grab it.
Was it 26?
Yeah, when you look at 26.5, and I'm working off the old House file version, I assume the numbers are the same. Okay. The second half of subdivision 1, because there's an or on 26.8, suggests that you can either meet the standards for continuing certification, continuing education under the NCPPA, or you can do something else, which suggests to me that you don't necessarily have to be certified by the organization, because if you weren't doing their ongoing educational requirements, I wouldn't think they'd be certifying you. So it suggests to me by language that even post-1995, that not necessarily everyone's going, whose license will be certified by this group. Am I missing something?
Mr. Ruffel.
Any physician assistant who wishes to register any newly registered physician assistant must be nationally certified.
Okay.
The language that you're referring mm-hmm. to attempts to say that since the ongoing continuing education requirements of national certification are more stringent than what the law reads, that as long as you continue to meet those criteria, then you will satisfy the requirements in law. Our national body requires 100 hours of continuing education every 2 years. So it's actually a more stringent requirement. So we were attempting to say that if you met that standard, you automatically satisfied the standard in statute.
Mr. Chair, I interpret that to mean then that not all of our folks would be certified, because some of them you're implying some of them won't meet the more rigorous standard of the national body.
Mr. Ruffel.
Are you telling me no, ours won't necessarily be certified by this national body on an ongoing basis if they're licensed under the new law?
Only those individuals who were registered in 1995 under the previous provisions of the grandfather clause would be required just that 50 hour.
I guess.
Everyone else has to be nationally certified, so would be subject to the higher, more stringent requirement.
Okay.
Representative Ava.
Well, I think part of when you get rid of grandfathering, there's some artifacts that you have to clean up.
Yes.
And I think part of that, I won't go any deeper in that. There's a bunch of other artifacts around. I just did some quick research about the Good Samaritan law, which you cite. There's new language on 2517 about the emergency according to 604A01. That's the Good Samaritan law you mentioned. And that actually gives you permission. If you're coming on as a guy with a half-severed arm, you're allowed to actually try to hold them together enough to do things that it'd be bad not to help them. That's what the Good Samaritan law is. So it doesn't really open it up very much. There's still a couple other questions, but I just thought I'd help people with that. And by the way, it was 1995 I looked that up. So.
Okay, thank you.
Very good. Are there additional questions? Are there anyone in the audience who is opposed to this? Okay. Representative Norton renews her motion that House File, Senate File 230 be recommend as amended. I'm sorry, as amended, be recommended to pass and be referred to the Health Human Services Policy Committee. Those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay, so it's passed.
Thank you.
Thank you. I'm up next.
No questions on this one.
Where is he going to laugh at Clint?
Professor Tao, are you ready to move your bill?
Madam Chair, I move for House File 535, recommend to pass and be referred to the Health Human Service Policy Committee.
Thank you, and go ahead and proceed.
Madam Chair and members, this was a provision that we passed out 2 years ago, and we're cleaning up some of the languages. And Mr. Gunn and the testifier will speak on it. Mr. Gunn's with the Attorney General's Office, appropriate name, I guess.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Representative Tao, I'm Stephen Gunn. I'm a Deputy Attorney General in the Attorney General's Office. With me today is Stephanie Lunning, and she's the Executive Director of the Board of Physical Therapy and is Chair of what is called the Executive Directors Forum, which is an informal organization of the 15 Health Licensing Board Executive Directors, and she's here to speak on behalf of the boards, and there's several Executive Directors here today. In 2007, the legislature passed a bill that had two parts. The first part provided that upon the request of a complainant to one of the 15 licensing boards, that the complainant could have their complaint reviewed by a representative of the Attorney General's Office. At the time, that was the practice, but there were a couple of the 15 boards that weren't following that practice. The second part of the bill went on to provide that there was a right to appeal the board's decision to the Attorney General within 30 days of receipt of the notice of the disposition of the complaint that had been made to that board. And that's the item that we're here today with House File 535 to correct. These two provisions have not gone into effect yet. They were delayed until August of this year. And there is an unintended consequence by creating this appeal notice. While it says there's a right to a notice of the right to appeal, there is not separately set forth anywhere else a right to appeal. And so the presumption is that this is and does create a right to appeal. The appeal would appear to go to the same Attorney General's office that has already been working with extensively and does the investigations for the board. And so it doesn't appear that it was really intended that would be the Attorney General's office that now would hear an appeal essentially of its own work along with the Health Licensing Board. The boards, as you may realize, are relatively small in terms of the number of employees. They rely upon extensive volunteer time from the board members who are appointed by the governor, and they spend a lot of time reviewing these complaints. The staff helps those boards, and our office does their investigations by statute, and we provide legal representation and counsel all through that process. But the consequence is essentially that we become the reviewing agency for our own work as well as a review for the review of the board, and that doesn't seem like it was intended. Ms. Lunning can speak to some of the other consequences.
Thank you for coming. Go ahead and introduce yourself.
Stephanie Lunning, Minnesota Board of Physical Therapy, here representing the Executive Directors Forum. Madam Chair, members of the committee, Representative Tao,
The language that we're suggesting be deleted as 535 did create some kind of unusual consequences. First of all, as Mr. Gunn said, it promotes a process that duplicates of what we're already doing. The Attorney General's office does review our cases, any closed cases, before we close them. So then if the complainant did do an appeal, we'd be sending it to another part of the Attorney General's office to, again, review it. It would also lead to the Attorney General's office and Board of Physical Therapy, particularly, I know well, but we use the Attorney General's office already for our complex investigations. And so in the appeal process, in the Attorney General's office, there'd be a duplication and require them to get the professional expertise that the boards get from consultants that they hire and from the actual board members who are professionals and often are leaders within their fields. And so the Attorney General's office would end up having to create sort of a new division within the health licensing to review probably hundreds of appeals that would come in on an annual basis. This would be costly and would essentially repeat the previous Attorney General's investigations or reviews. In addition, there really isn't any rationale that we could find to substantiate that the results of the second Attorney General's review or investigation would substantially differ from the first one. Although the complainant might feel like they're getting the possibility of a different outcome, it's going to be just another group at the Attorney General's office repeating what they did the first time, so it would add considerable operational and administrative costs both for the Attorney General's office and the board without any benefit to the consumer. And then the last thing is the Attorney General's office, if they did these appeals, it would really alter the role that they play with the boards. Currently, the Attorney General's office advises the boards on procedural aspects of complaints, assists in the collection of evidence and investigation, provides legal representation to the committees during the conferences, negotiates settlements, and represents the boards in any litigation. This law, as without the House File 535, if it were to go into effect, would remove the ultimate responsibility for discipline from the board and shift it to the Attorney General's office. And it would make the Attorney General's office become the decision maker on professional and clinical aspects of complaints relating to health professional license. So it would also lead possibly to a complainant who isn't pleased with the level of discipline. So if the case was closed with a reprimand, the complainant may want it to be a suspension, and that could possibly be an appeal. Or a suspension was given, they might want a revocation. So the process just could go on and on and on. So I'm here to ask for your support of House File 535. Okay, stand for any questions.
Thanks. I remember this thing. I was in the middle of it all. And actually, Mr. Gunn, we did mean for the Attorney General to review stuff. And that was the intent back then. We didn't know it would be so expensive. And if we repeal this, would it be a savings we can use to balance part of the budget then in the forecast, which must be reflected in all your budgets? And so just let me ask a question. So we're keeping, it was helpful to look at this thing. So I remember some of the hearings, and I remember the situation. And the complainant can still request a review by the Attorney General, which they would then do internally without a formal process. Is that correct?
That's right. The 2007 language that refers to the complainant being able to seek a review by our office will happen, and in fact it does happen. It simply at that time, in 2007, was not the practice of every one of the 15 boards. The boards are all independent, and two or three of them didn't follow that. They are following it now, and certainly when that provision goes into effect, which is not covered by this change, it will be followed by the boards. That's my understanding.
Okay.
And I appreciate that. And just one thing else, I just was chatting with one of your witnesses on the earlier here about the letters that go out, and I think part of this was driven by letters that weren't clear. And in the, well, you would probably write them yourself, Mr. Gunn, but, you know, you have to be careful to say nothing, and you can't at least talk. And so I hope that out of part of this that the boards have developed a series of letters that could give as limited as information as they can, but say, yeah, we really did think the guy was guilty, but he got away on a technicality. We're looking for more information. He really was, or that more rather that the one that didn't go out, I think, in this situation was he was really fine. Everything, he followed everything, and if there's no more information to find, we uncover every rock. And so I support the fix. So, thanks.
I have a question. If it was, well, first of all, the issue of the background to it, who is it who brought these changes forward in 2007? And Representative Abler just suggested that it was their intent for, you know, review by the Attorney General. So was it their intent to find some avenue appeal, whether this is the correct avenue or not?
Madam Chair, this was Representative Walker's bill in 2007. The only discussion I had, and I did have a discussion mm-hmm. with Representative Walker at that time, was that the representative did not believe there was enough involvement from the Attorney General's office in reviewing the material. Mm-hmm. I did not think at that time that she thought that it was necessary to put us over the board in the sense of having people be able to appeal a decision mm-hmm. to us so much as review it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that was reflected mm-hmm. in the first part of the enactment, but then in the second part, somehow the appeal language still appeared.
Mm-hmm.
Representative Abler is correct. Part of what the additional changes there, you can see on that sheet that we passed out,
mm-hmm.
the board will now be giving a written description of the board's complaint process plus the actions of the board. That often, in my experience with the boards over the last 10 years, has led to a lot of misunderstandings
mm-hmm.
If they got a letter that simply said closed or
mm-hmm.
or thank you for your letter. Mm-hmm. They now, with this change, and even we're working towards it before, explain the board's process, mm-hmm. explain in detail all the steps that have gone through. In fact, our office, our lawyers in our office make sure that these boards all follow their own internal procedures and make sure that every step is followed, which can be a very elaborate process for many of the boards in terms of multiple reviews by professionals, mm-hmm. independent
mm-hmm.
professionals,
mm-hmm.
of the conduct of the physician, for instance, or others in the case.
Mm-hmm.
And so I believe that Representative Walker's concerns, as well as another representative who came to her, have been met. And we
mm-hmm.
have talked to everyone that was involved at the time, both myself and Ms. Lunning and some others,
mm-hmm.
and they're satisfied that the changes have been put in place.
Mm-hmm. I have an additional question regarding clarification. If we were to pass this change, then, if a complainant received their letter and was dissatisfied with the outcome, am I correct that their only recourse would then be to file a lawsuit against the board, and then the AG's office would represent the board in the lawsuit?
Madam Chair, there's no due process requirement when a government agency receives a complaint from a citizen and they,
mm-hmm.
they don't take action mm-hmm. on that complaint. More likely their remedy would be if there was some harm that was done
mm-hmm.
to them or a family member, would not be to sue the board, but would be to sue the practitioner.
Okay.
But that's independent. This just gets at the licensure aspect of the licensing conduct regulation.
Let me follow up a little further then, because Ms. Lanning mentioned there might be hundreds of appeals. It's a large number. Well, not when we're talking about budgets anymore, but it's a large number and a cost. Are you suggesting then that hundreds of people might be pursuing lawsuits against individual practitioners if we don't provide some other recourse for them to feel if their voice was adequately heard in the process?
Madam Chair, I don't believe that would be the case. I think the number of medical malpractice cases, for instance, would not be affected by
mm-hmm.
this.
Mm-hmm.
A determination, in fact, there's a number of evidentiary problems mm-hmm. in using information generated by these boards in your civil litigation case mm-hmm. in any event. Mm-hmm. Every year there's cases that make it more difficult oftentimes for a plaintiff to recover based upon a board action anyway. So it's, mm-hmm. it really makes no difference in that arena. The information that Ms. Lunning put together, I believe, is over 3,000 complaints are filed with these boards each year. Uh-huh. And we anticipate that we would receive hundreds, if not thousands, of appeals of people who were not totally happy mm-hmm. with the outcome of their complaints that they filed with the board. Mm-hmm. And that would be a burden, yes.
Okay. Any questions from any other members? So Representative Tao will renew his motion to pass and to refer to the Health and Human Services Policy Committee. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed? The motion is passed. Thank you.
Okay, Representative Avery, I think you're last. Oh, you're there.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Oh,
second
I'm sorry, Representative Murphy.
Gave Representative Murphy a heart attack. And under the Good Samaritan law, the PA is going to come down and help her out. So. Well, they left, so, well.
All right, Representative Avery moves that House File 565 be recommended passed and be referred to the Health Human Service Policy Committee.
And Mr. Chair, I have a technical oral amendment to offer. There's some typos on there in three places, I believe, where it says Council of, and it should say Council on. And one of those is on my 1.16.
Oh. Okay, 1.16.
Well, actually, there's two of them on my 1.16.
So hold on, Representative Abel, we're talking about the bill, the amendment.
To the bill.
Okay, the bill. Okay.
I think wherever it says Council of Chiropractic something or other, it should say Council on. I think there's four places the staff can find those. I'd like to incorporate that into the... Or do we have to vote on that?
Ms. Ave, how do we do that? Representative Ave asked that the...
I'll move the amendment and we just vote on the amendment.
Okay.
There's four ofs to be on.
Representative Ave moves that we change from board... of to bore on.
Yeah, there are some line 1.16 and 1.23.
Okay.
Sorry. Thank you. Let's just say Council on.
Council on. Okay. There we go. 1.16 right there. Okay, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay, amendment adopted.
And Mr. Chair, I have an amendment. Do you want to just put that on and talk about it, or what do you do? What's your pleasure?
Your amendment?
Yeah.
The A2, I believe, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, why don't you move it, and then
okay,
we'll
move
vote
the
on.
Amendment.
And then we'll talk about the whole bill.
Okay.
Can we?
Representative Abel moves the A2 amendment in the form. What?
I just have a procedural question.
Yeah.
Chair Tao. I have concerns and questions about the amendment. I'm wondering if it would be appropriate after it's amended on, or if you want those ahead of time, at the time before we vote on the amendment.
Why don't we do this, Representative Abler? Why don't we do the bill first?
Yeah.
You describe the bill first, and then you will describe the amendment, and then we'll vote on the amendment, or have those that might have concerns on the amendment discuss the amendment. How's that?
I asked you what your pleasure was, and if that's your pleasure, that's what we'll do, Mr. Chair.
Okay, Representative Ava.
You are the chair.
Through the bill.
This is the bill itself is quite technical, and rather than bore you with my details, I'll let my witness give you his details. But no, they won't be boring. They'll be very interesting. He has like a 1 minute thing to say. Go ahead, there are 2 minutes.
Thank you. Members of the committee, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'll be glad to bore you with the details. Very simply,
state your name for the record.
Sorry. My name is Dr. Larry Spicer. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Board of Chiropractic Examiners. And this is essentially kind of a housekeeping bill. The primary accrediting agency for chiropractic colleges in this country and in other countries, in some other countries, is called the Council on Chiropractic Education. It is approved by the U.S. Department of Education to provide accreditation. The current statute, 148.06, also allows for the accreditation or the acceptance of accreditation from other schools from other countries, for example, Canada, Australia, colleges in Europe, and England, and places like that, provided they have what is known as a reciprocal agreement with the Council on Chiropractic Education. And essentially what that means is they have an agreement that they will utilize accreditation standards that are essentially the same as those in accredited United States accredited colleges. About a year and a half ago, the Council on Chiropractic Education sort of unilaterally supplanted all of those reciprocal agreements for a new structure. And the new structure was they created a body called the Council on Chiropractic International, which was like an umbrella. And then under that, they have a Council on Chiropractic United States, Council on Chiropractic Canada, Council on Chiropractic Europe, and one for Australia as well. And so what's happened is the reciprocal agreements have been supplanted now with agreements between the Council on Chiropractic International and the other national Council on Chiropractic Education. And so all we're doing here is we're modifying the language to appreciate that change and recognize the dissolution of the reciprocal agreement.
Very good. Okay, I don't believe there's any questions on this bill, but Representative Ava, why don't you explain your amendment, and then we'll have questions on those.
And this amendment has nothing to do with reciprocal agreements, Mr. Chair. Okay. The bill is quite technical. The amendment is not technical, but it's minor. The situation that exists, in many clinic settings, and I'm not attempting to drink the ocean, I'm just trying to help a little subset of people who I know about specifically, but many professions are in the same boat. But this is a chiropractic bill, and I thought we'd just help chiropractic widows. Situation is if your spouse is a chiropractor and he or she happens to die, you have 90 days to just divest yourself of the business. So not only do you go, and if the kind of person to be involved would be somebody who'd be probably in their 40s, 50s, or 60s. If you're 70 and retiring, you would have made some plans to have an associate and you're buying it out, or an 80, you're certainly done with that. These are untimely deaths, generally, and it's mostly a widow who's the person having to deal with these considered quite a preponderance of men chiropractors compared to women, although the younger ones are kind of growing to be more at par. And so this would give them some time to make a sale in a more timely fashion. And they would obviously not do any clinical work. They'd just be allowed to hire an associate and come in and clean up. And I would suspect that most of these wouldn't last even 2 years. But this gives them time to make a proper sale. In the case of many of these families, this is one of the primary assets that they still have besides their house. And so the value of the clinic, knowing it has to be sold in 90 days, drops like a stone. So often just the value of the equipment. And this way, they would be allowed to carry on and get their a more proper value. So it's meant to be a small effort.
Representative Abel, do you know of any other profession where your amendment might be moving into similar timeline?
The law requires 90 days for
everybody.
Yeah.
Okay.
And so at some point they might want the same relief, which I would support that. But this is meant to be a narrow bill for a narrow day. Does that help?
Representative Norton.
Move my name tag right over there, please. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I really appreciate you doing this for the few wee people that you know that might have this issue. And I'm not unsympathetic. This is a non-controversial bill, which I'm very happy to vote for. This, on the other hand, to me is a commerce issue that could affect many, many businesses and is, frankly, a big change in the state law, even though you're only trying to change it for small people. I think it, it deserves a broader discussion in a committee that deals with this issue so that we can see if we're setting precedent that might affect every other business that might have someone die an untimely death. And so I think if we're going to start discussing divesting businesses, I would prefer not to deal with this little wee slot out of the context of the larger issue of what would happen in law with other businesses. And so I don't think it's a little issue. I think it's a very big issue, and it belongs in a larger bill. And Mr. Chair, if the will of the committee is to add this amendment on, I unfortunately would have to vote against the bill. But if it should pass, it does not go to, in my opinion, and I'm just offering advice, Mr. Chair, that this bill then shouldn't go to healthcare policy. It belongs to Commerce or one of the other committees that would discuss business type issues. That's my advice, and I know it's unsolicited, so I apologize.
I you're right. You might have a point. It will probably end up in first in policy, and then it might have to travel to Commerce and get it worked out there.
Mr. Chair, I'm very happy to talk to the chair and see what he thinks.
So
of Commerce, so I'll ask him if he would like to see it. If he does, we'll go visit Commerce.
Okay, you're not withdrawing the amendment.
No, I'm happy to. I like the one for rides. You just never know who you're going to meet along the way. And
all
Commerce
right.
is a very friendly, interesting committee to meet. You can learn so much when you go there.
All right, Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, do you know within the chiropractic profession, is there counseling on from your governing board on setting up practices and on buy-sell agreements and on the need to have both buyout life insurance and buyout insurance for the practice in general? It's fairly standard practice in most other businesses, that particularly whether or not you have partners, that you have buyout insurance in case of an untimely death. Is that customary within the chiropractic field? Or
the board, you can ask the executive director who's sitting right here next to me.
Mr. Spicer.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dean, not from the regulatory board. However, I do believe those issues are addressed through the professional association.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And maybe an oral amendment to after in 1.5 after chiropractic clinic or architecture profession office, if we could add that. Might be a good one to add in. But just I just think that would be unusual to carve out this one particular clinic for something within the business interest. I guess it's just kind of coming out of left field.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah, Representative Ely.
I just asked Dr. Spicer here about this a couple days ago. I thought there were five, and he told me that there were, on the average, 5 to 8 per year. And I don't know how they go, and I'm sure some have the foresight to do this, but compared to the architectural firms, which are probably incorporated with a group, there are many, many sole proprietorship chiropractors, especially in the older ones, and in the medical world, there are very few one-horse doctors anymore. Maybe in the rural areas you'll find them. But I think it may be unique to the profession, at least more unique to this one than some other ones. And so, we're talking probably about 5 people a year. And so I'm willing to chat with the Commerce Chair. So,
Representative Abler, do you know why did we pick the 90 days?
Maybe the Executive Director of the Chiropractic Board knows the answer to that.
Mr. Spicer?
Mr. Chair, I can't answer that. I know that the 90 days was established in 319B, and I believe that it also existed in the parent of 319B, which was 319A. So I think it's been around for quite a long time, but I don't know why.
And Mr. Chair, I do know. I mean, I know a fair amount of the history part of this. And having seen some of the happenings of some of my colleagues' wives as they struggle through, they have to both go through the grieving process and then work on selling this place. And that's the point of the bill. But the 90 days, part of it has to do with who can run a clinic or not. And can you have out-of-state people owning clinics? And that's, but the thing about that's different about here is none of these guys plan to die. You know, they didn't just die cleverly so their wife could run a clinic from Florida or something. So These are all untimely. None of these are planned. And so if they did know if they had terminal cancer or something, they would actually make some provision. But these are the ones with a car accident, they're out doing some, they fall off a mountain or something. And so that's the population. It's just a minute subset of people to drag through the world of the corporate, world of business takeovers. And that's the point of the bill. So it's meant to be a small little piece, and that's my, I'm sticking with my intention as it being narrow.
Well, I'm curious to know as to why they have that 90 day, and I understand the economic of it. Is that is hanging over your head? Yeah, the value of your business will be pretty low for anyone to take over. So,
Mr. Chair, if I may,
Mr. Spiker,
thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to expand just a little bit on the 90 days. The 90-day dissolution requirement in 319B, really the language that's used there says when a governance authority, which is actually an owner, it's another name for an owner, the governance authority loses its eligibility. You can lose your eligibility through a number of different ways, including license revocation, termination, you leave the state, you retire. There's a whole number of ways you can lose your eligibility. Only one of them happens to be to the death of the owner. And so it may simply have been oversight that the legislature at the time they crafted that simply didn't think about that particular outcome.
I just might make a recommendation that the purview of this committee is licensure and the scope of practice, and this is clearly a business amendment. Maybe what we could do is just pass it on. If you need to do it in commerce, then they could take it up there. That might be a way to get it, keep it moving so it keeps on its merry way.
Well, I was just thinking of leaving up to the purview of the committee, but because we're going to do a delete on it in the...
And the vehicle will be alive if we want to move it.
And so I would like us to at least put it on as a vehicle. And I am concerned about that 90-day. I understand the economics of it. And so what I guess we'll let the committee vote on. It's on, it's on. If it's not, introduce us a bill and go to Congress. So all those in favor of... the A2 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Sounds like there's 4-2, so the noes have it.
Are you sure, Mr. Chair?
I'm pretty sure. My ear is pretty good.
Why?
Amendment fail? Did you want division?
No. Why,
Okay, amendment fail. Okay, on to the bill. Representative Abler renewed his motion for House File 565 as amended. Recommend it pass and be referred to the Health Human Service Policy Committee. Those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay. A bill is on its way. Thank you, Representative Abler. Representative Murphy.
I call that.
We'll do it again. Representative Murphy. Representative Murphy, as soon as she moves up, she's going to move House File 1077 and be recommended pass and be referred to the Health Human Service Policy Committee. Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I have an amendment that I'd like to add to the bill to get the bill into the order that I'd like. It is the A1 amendment, and there's an oral amendment to that amendment on page 2.
Representative Murphy moves the oral amendment to the amendment.
In line 2.21, I would like to strike the word accredited. Actually, I'd like to also change the word "an" to
Representative Murphy? 2.21?
On page 2 of the amendment, line 2.21.
Oh, I was looking up there. Okay, got it.
So it would read, an individual employed in a sleep lab, etc.
Okay, a sleep lab. So Representative Murphy moves to amend 2.21 and incorporates 2.21, strike an accredit and put an A. Insert A. Okay, the amendment, the author wants to move the amendment.
I move the A1 amendment.
Representative Murphy moves the A1 amendment to the shape that the author wants. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, adopt. The amendment is adopted.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 1077 is legislation to change the status of respiratory therapists from a profession that is registered to one that is licensed. Minnesota is the last state of the contiguous 48 to license respiratory therapists, and I have a posse of people here that would like to talk with you about that. So I'm going to turn my time over to them.
So, Representative Murphy, we are farther ahead than the physician's assistant.
My name is Kelly Klein. I am the president for the Minnesota Society for Respiratory Care. I am a respiratory therapist and have been for 28 years. I have two people with me today that are going to talk with you regarding our profession and why we want to go from registration to licensure. The first person is Terry Barassa. She is our legislative co-chair for legislative affairs. And the other person is Alex Adams. He is on the Respiratory Advisory Council for the Minnesota Board of Medical Practice. Thank you so much for hearing us today.
State your name for the record.
Absolutely. Thank you again for hearing us. My name is Carrie Barassa. I've been a respiratory therapist or a respiratory care practitioner, also known as RCP, in the state of Minnesota for about 15 years, and I'm, as Shelley said, the legislative co-chair for the Minnesota Society for Respiratory Care. The purpose of our proposed legislative changes is to make them transition from mere registration to licensure, and the benefits are many, which have been provided for your review. I believe that you've got the 10 reasons to license, which lists them nicely. Any questions that you have, we'll be happy to answer. Our main concern is public safety and the regulation of respiratory therapists working in Minnesota without being regulated by the Board of Medical Practice because they have circumvented the title RCP. With registration, this is title protection only, and with Minnesota being the last of the lower 48, we are concerned that we could potentially become a magnet for those respiratory therapists who have been reprimanded or lost their license or had it withdrawn in other states. There have already been deaths in Minnesota related to this issue. This profession is an invasive profession. It is ICU. People are on ventilators. It's codes. It's life and death. Traumas. We want these people to be under the respiratory care scope of practice, and we want them to be required to be licensed by the Board of Medical Practice. There are individuals who may have taken a national exam and passed but have not become regulated in Minnesota. Therefore, these individuals are not required to demonstrate the needed continuing education nor possibly have background checks to see if their licensure was affected in other states. We believe this to be a very serious patient issue. We're not looking to change our scope of practice, nor are we looking to change anyone else's scope of practice. There are lots of things that we do that overlap, and together those things give us healthy patients and a multidisciplinary approach. This does not increase costs, as to the respiratory therapist or to the state. It is self-funding. We are through the Board of Medical Practice. The process will not change to go from registration to licensure. And this should not cause limitations for jobs because it actually should make reciprocity much easier because we're the last of the lower 48. The last study done was shown that there was no wage increase due to licensure. And we now have just found out that Hawaii has even introduced their licensure, so that would make us only one left. Puerto Rico even has licensure, which is good for them. I'm happy for them. So,
what about Guam?
You know what? One step at a time, right? But they can go to Puerto Rico and get great respiratory care. The hospital association put out a letter regarding several of the licensure bills, and they deemed that the RT switch to licensure was an appropriate change, and we believe that that is also reflective of the cost that we're not going to be getting any raises anytime soon, and that the economy as well as, you know, as the wages are driven by location and by education, and actually in Minnesota we make more than a lot of other states do. So, again, we ask for you to vote in favor of this legislation to maintain the safety of our patients and find all the practices under the census to be licensed in the great state of Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm next. I'm Alex Adams. I've been a respiratory care practitioner for 39 years, and I want to thank Representative Murphy for sponsoring this effort. I'm speaking mostly from my experience of being on the Respiratory Care Advisory Council of the Board of Medical Practice. Registration, as one representative pointed out, was a voluntary process and could have been adequate, and we've been registered since 1993. The process is no longer adequate, and this is because of great frustrations that have been dealt with by the Board of Medical Practice. There are a group of, I'll call it, for no better term, scammers who have found ways to evade the regulatory process, and these practitioners are practicing in an unregulated environment, and they, I assume, are like everybody else who we have been regulating, and the Board of Medical Practice does an excellent job of isolating and caring for and dealing with people who have drug abuse problems, alcohol problems, continuing education problems, boundary issues, incompetence, deal with privacy issues, and all physicians, nurses, and respiratory care practitioners have those problems. But if you're not in the regulatory system, nobody knows about it, and citizens are in jeopardy. And these practitioners that have surfaced in the last 2 years are a result of a number of complaints we've received. We don't know about the ones who haven't been complained about, but they're of three types. 7 complaints have isolated a dozen or more practitioners who are clearly violating the system, and they have been applied for the system and now have stiffs and orders against them for having practiced for years unregulated. They typically have had no continuing education over this time, and they have to catch up. So that's an obvious problem for somebody who isn't regulated. There are a group of people who are certified by taking the national exam and entitled themselves RRTs and CRTs. This is a protected title, and we cannot engulf that into the Registration Act. So they can practice, and we cannot really do much about them other than their place of employment has to state that they need to be in the regulatory system. Last week, we dealt with a complaint that of an aide who was practicing respiratory care, from what we were told that was obvious they're practicing respiratory care, I asked the Assistant Attorney General, who was at our meeting, Steve Mastin, if this activity was another justification for licensure, and he said yes. The frustrations of the Attorney General's office and the Board of Medical Practice have grown, and we are now a part of trying to remedy this problem, and we urge and hope you can consider it, and we're happy to try to respond to any questions.
Ms. Barrosa, right?
Yes.
Is this bill going to address those RTs, the CRTs, who have been kicked out of other states?
Well, if I may just address, just, you know, we have a two-tiered credentialing system that is by the NBRC, which is the National Board for Respiratory Care. They are the accredited organization to do the testing. So that is a nationally recognized credential. So, therefore, these people may have passed the test 25 years ago, but until 2002, there was no regulation that required them to, other than if they were regulated with the Board of Medical Practice, prove any kind of continuing education. Now, individuals after 2002 have to provide that information. But we have a whole group of individuals that, if they come into Minnesota, registration is title protection only. If they call themselves a CRT, or a certified respiratory technician, or a registered respiratory technician, those are national credentials, but that does not mean that they are registered with the Board of Medical Practice. So we do not know who those people are, but we know that there are hospitals hiring them. And unfortunately, as I mentioned, we've had deaths in Minnesota related to this issue, and those were uncredentialed respiratory therapists. And the reasons why someone would want to hire an uncredentialed or unregulated respiratory therapist, I gratefully can say that I don't know the answer to that, because I would not want the liability. And most organizations here recognize the, you know, invasiveness and the scope of our practice, and that what we do is invasive, and if people's lives are at stake, and therefore they hire respiratory therapists who have had background checks, and that are regulated through our Board of Medical Practice. We're required to have 24 CEUs every 2 years, so 12 a year. Does that answer your question, sir?
Representative Abel?
Yeah.
Thank you. You know, I was interested when Abel's too much. The whole thing about this soft law term is, I had to just work that in. I don't know that the bill is going to protect you like you think. And I don't know, I mean, the people are going to hire people to do stuff if they, unless you make people hire licensed people with your credentials. Just to help you out and make you feel more nervous, you've unprotected the term respiratory care practitioner. They could go be one of those now.
No, so you, that is gone.
No, you crossed it off as a protected term. It's an unprotected term now.
Yeah.
And just so you know, and so that they could call themselves that, just to point out what your bill does. They could call themselves respiratory care technician. You cross, so those are not protected, I'm just telling you. And so they could so what's your view? A licensure bill mostly protects the title and gives a list of criteria to achieve that title. And so unless people are forbidden, and I'm supporting your bill, I'm just telling you what, without having the county attorney who works for your board going after people that break your law, you have no real assurance you're going to protect any of the harm that you warned about. Just telling you that.
Mr. Adams or Ms. Barroso?
Mr. Chair and Mr. Representative, the intent is precisely to remedy that problem.
Yeah.
The bill will now state that those practicing respiratory care, not those who
claim a title. If it can be determined that within the scope of practice they are practicing respiratory care, they will have to be licensed. And if they violate that law, it will be a gross misdemeanor that will be investigated and hopefully prosecuted by a county attorney. That's the intent. There still may be people who attempt to change names and dodge it, but if they can be determined that they are practicing respiratory care, they will be required to be licensed.
Well, I understand that they're going to be required to be licensed. You can attempt to do all kinds of things. I'm just telling you that the dance will continue. And you may not want to protect, you may not want to unprotect those terms, is what I'm telling you. You might like to protect the term respiratory care practitioner. Not that you're going to use it, but then they can't use it legally. Or respiratory, just as a thought, it's just, you might want to go back and revisit that as this bill moves along.
Mr. Chair, Representative Engler, I would be delighted to confer with you about that as the bill moves along.
Yeah.
It looks like the committee is open to having you have some more protection.
Good. Yeah, I want to caution you. The county attorneys, this is a licensure issue all the time. You know, they're chasing rapists and drug dealers and, you're pounding someone the way that looks like you're doing respiratory therapy. It's not high on their list, even if it's a gross misdemeanor. So I just want to... And so the best thing to do is advertise to the hospitals, whoever hires these people, that there is a difference. And that and hopefully people want to select a highly competent practitioner. And that's what we kind of hope for, why probably license nurses and chiropractors and everybody else. And so people seek that. But just wanted to, in my world, I don't run into people that are doing bad respiratory therapy. It's not part of my niche. But I just say that to be helpful to you as you go about your way.
Representative Bunn?
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like some clarification on a couple of issues about the levels of regulation that are possible here. You mentioned a little while ago that the deaths that may have occurred were by uncredentialed folks. And yet you indicated just prior to that statement that you were talking about nationally certified and registered people. So I assume it wasn't that they were uncredentialed, but they were credentialed at the other level and didn't meet your state, what you'd like
they
to
were
have.
They were unregulated.
In our state, yes.
My apologies.
Mm-hmm.
Representative Bunn?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The big change here is about, I'm going to go to section. The real big change here is really captured in starting on line 4.17, in that we're now going to require everyone to be licensed and other folks in a much more strict limitation on non-licensed people as to what they can do, and which is typically the case when moving to licensure from lower levels of regulation. It's not clear to me that a lower level of regulation couldn't solve the problems. Two things are not clear to me. One is, and this is just a general hierarchy I like to use in thinking about this, number one is you've mentioned some anecdotes about there's been some safety issues, possibly even leading to death. In general, going forward in this committee, as long as I would be here, I'd want to know, like, how big a problem are we talking about? Anecdotes aren't really enough for me. I know it's hard to get that data. And because I know there's a lot of instances of respiratory therapy, you know, every day of the year. And so two or three instances of something going wrong would be a very, very, very small statistical number relative to the overall. But more importantly, even assuming there is a safety problem, the question is why state certification that has a level of education and ongoing educational requirements that goes beyond the national certification or registration that's in place couldn't be put in place with education around that to the people who might hire folks like this that said, you know, we have higher state standards. You know, if you're looking at the market for, you know, respiratory therapists, you should, you know, the best signal for you of quality is state certification.
But you don't go so far as to saying no one else can, you know, practice these occupations or these practices. Why is it we could not do that in this case?
Mr. Adams?
Yes, Mr. Chair and Mr. Representative. Our state system of registration right now has been adequate for quite a while until this recent group of people have been evading the system. And being on the committee, there are a number of applicants from other states who try to practice here, and some of them are fine. It's no problem. And there's now increasing activity, people renting people for 8 weeks and 10 week stints. And they, we need to examine them carefully. And our regulatory system is tough. In fact, it's tougher than many, many other states. So for a long time, our registration system was one of the tougher ones, and it was my opinion, being on the committee, I felt sort of the same way you're expressing it, that why do we need to toughen things up if people have trouble practicing Minnesota because we make demands on continuing education, on their experience, on the fact that they can't have had infractions in their practice. Mm-hmm. So we were one of the toughest states. Our problem now is not that we need to be tougher. We have people who are getting around us, who are trying to capture, who have learned that you don't have to be regulated at all in Minnesota if you use this title, that title, or if you state you're an aide, or if you get away with it as long as you can. The licensure will see that those practitioners are brought into the regulatory system. The regulatory system has been very active, and we generate a report every year of all of our activities, and it shows that there's you know, a real necessity to regulate because of all the problems that occur with any large group of people. And the people who are outside of the system, we can't account for. And we know that some of them are malpracticing, but we don't have much more than anecdotes because they're trickling in right now. The number in the last 2 years has overwhelmed the Board of Medical Practice, and they're the ones who are urging us to be here because of the administrative problems and the Attorney General's office. Every time they get a complaint, they have to get records and get evidence, and they're saying, well, wait a second, you know, you're not acting like you're even regulated because you've got so many complaints. That's really, really why we're here. It's the issue of the complaints we're trying to deal with and the practitioners that we know are getting out of the regulatory system.
That's
good,
right? Your follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, first of all, what you appear to have in practice currently is really certification, not registration, in terms of you have education requirements. And since you have currently education and continuing education requirements?
Yes.
So, okay, so really what you have is what we typically think of as certification. So I clearly would support a change in name to that. Secondly, though, even if we talk about licensure, what I don't know, what's not before us now, and this comes up in a lot of different areas of licensing, is I have no idea how our current regime, even the registration regime in terms of education, ongoing education examination, compares to any of those other 48 states that have licensure currently. I don't know if it's that our current regime in terms of the education, ongoing education and testing requirements is less stringent, more stringent, the same stringent. And one of the issues we have in Minnesota typically is we actually tend to be a little more stringent, as you said, okay? So we have difficulty with reciprocity when stout people move from other states because they can't become a physical therapist or some other group here because we have more levels of education that are required. And I just feel that if we go forward with this without knowing that information or having it before us, that we might create once again a reciprocity problem or a barrier to entry that is beyond which is either justified by the harm data or good for competitiveness, economic competitiveness of our state and our industry. So I just, not that I oppose what you're doing, but I just don't think we have, I mean, the harm data may be hard to get, but at least I could see the, well, how do we stack up with what you're suggesting should be the regulatory environment in terms of those education and community education exam, because we don't have it before us, I know.
All right, are there any additional questions? Okay, the chair renews President Murphy's motion that House File 1077 be recommended pass and be referred to the Health Human Service Policy Committee. Those as amended. Those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay, bill is passed and we adjourn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.